Today's Animal Spirits Talk Book is brought to you by Simplify Asset Management. Go to simplify.us to learn more about the Simplify Terra India Opportunities ETF. That's simplify.us.
Welcome to Animal Spirits, a show about markets, life, and investing. Join Michael Batnick and Ben Carlson as they talk about what they're reading, writing, and watching. All opinions expressed by Michael and Ben are solely their own opinion and do not reflect the opinion of Ritholtz Wealth Management. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for any investment decisions. Clients of Ritholtz Wealth Management may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast.
Welcome to Animal Spirits with Michael and Ben. Michael, if you sell me on consumers spending money, that's all I need to hear. Right? For a macro theme.
You are a sucker for a good spender.
So we talk about, India has been in the news. I don't know. It's been a nice run for the last, 12, 18 months, the stock market. And it's one of those fool me once situations. Like, listen, emerging markets, growing middle class, consumers going to spend money. I've heard this before. And it didn't work out that well for the BRICS. Or China especially, right?
Yeah. Is there a end?
And so India is apparently going to be the next China. 1 billion people, growing middle class, coming out of poverty, ready to spend money. And the question that we pose on the podcast today is, okay, what makes India different?
Yeah, this was an interesting episode. I learned a lot, particularly that it sounds like they're not just reliant on, now listen, okay, the demographic tailwinds is obviously an enormous part of the story, but there's real companies there that are not just reliant on other emerging economies. Like they're selling massive deals to Western economies.
Yeah, it actually, the story makes sense. The thing that I realize is that India has always traded at a valuation premium to the US. So it seems like it could be prone to huge boom and bust cycles if that's the case. But the opportunity set for consumers reaching a specific per capita level of GDP, and then that's when they decide to, okay, we've passed the needs level. Now we're going into the wants and desires and discretionary spending. That whole thesis makes sense to me. So for today's show, we talked to Anupam Ghosh, who is a managing partner at System 2 Advisors, which is a sub-advisor to Simplify, and they have an active India ETF. It's more concentrated, but he had some really interesting thoughts on not only the macro setup, but also investing in India and some of the opportunities there. So here is our conversation with Anupam. We're joined today by Anupam Ghosh. He is a managing partner at System 2 Advisors for the Simplify Terra India Opportunities ETF. IOPP, is that correct?
That is correct, Ben.
All right. So wanted to get into this. We've had a number of people on the show in the last couple of weeks and months talking about China. And I feel like I've heard about the emerging markets opportunity for years now, especially coming out of like the 2008 crisis. The idea was the U.S. is going to have slower, U.S. and the rest of developed economies are going to have slower growth because of demographics. And then in the emerging markets, you're going to have way faster growth because there's tons of people, they're younger, better demographics. There's going to be more consumer spending. And so I'm curious to hear your take on India as a whole. Like, why isn't India China? What makes it different? Because there's 1 billion people and economic growth is faster and a rising middle class and the consumer class. So what makes it different in terms of translating that into stock market returns?
Sure. Ben, and that I think you've hit the nail on the head, which is the demographic dividend. And I'm proud to tell you that I'm a dropout of a PhD program in economics. And while economists have very, very, very arcane, jargony sort of definitions of what the demographic dividend is, I have a much more pedestrian explanation, which is if you have a large enough population and your per capita GDP gets to about $2,000, discretionary consumption sets in. You begin to demand a $1,000 phone, $1,500 TV, you know, $10,000 car, et cetera, et cetera. That sets off a chain of self-sustaining consumer discretionary spending, which takes GDP per capita from $2,000 to $6,000 in a straight line. That translates to about two decades of 10-ish% growth. We saw that movie in China, 95 to 2015. Now they're caught in the middle of the trap and they're headed down, like, you know, or they're sliding sideways, you know. In India, the demographic dividend is just started, where the per capita GDP is about $2,300. So we believe the next two decades for India will be absolutely the best decades in terms of consumer discretionary spending. And that is reflected in the average age in India, which is a full 10 years younger than that of China.
So we're having like a baton handoff here from like China had their 20, 30 years of growth, and India is going to take that and do the same thing, similarly at least.
I'm sorry, Ben, did you call it a baton?
Sorry, baton handoff? What did I? Close enough. But so my big question is, so China had this unbelievable growth, but their stock market went nowhere, it seems like. So why is India different in terms of the stock market then? How is that growth going to translate into better returns for investors?
Got it. Great question, which is India is a plural, multi-ethnic democracy with a relatively, you know, sort of compared to China, a free economy, freedom of expression, a democracy. You know, India's been a mercantilist economy or a country for the last 5,000 years. You know, what happened in China, where essentially, you know, due to the Cultural Revolution and the Communist Party, they effectively wiped out all institutions of, you know, what we deem modern capitalistic infrastructure. And India has always been there. If you look at how old the Bombay Stock Exchange is, it's about 200 years old. Like, you know, so there's always been a sort of a history of mercantilist slash free marketish economies. That had changed somewhat after the country got independence and it took a more socialist turn. But all that reversed again in 1990 when the economy opened up. You know,
I was listening to a conversation that you and Brian had, and he shared an incredible data point, which is that 42% of India's population is under 24 years old and only 21% is over age 50. My question is, why now? Like, India's stock market has been red hot. It's been all over the news. Was there a catalyst, or was this just the demographic tailwind of people coming into sort of peak earning years? Like, what exactly lit the fuse?
You know, there's nothing that's sort of lit the fuse. There's one watershed event that we can point to saying, this is what caused the growth. Or the markets to take off. If you go back to say 2002, 2003, GDP was about $500 billion. Today it's $4.2 trillion. Markets, the Nifty was 800. Today it's 23,000. Now, all that is good, but question is, where is the GDP headed? You know, by most conservative estimates, in the next 5 years, the GDP will grow from 4.2 trillion to about 7.5 trillion, where India will overtake both Germany and Japan to become the third largest economy in the world. Like, you know, so as GDP is growing, the markets and just beta continues to grow with it. If you look at the last 20 years, that shows you that. You know, now, again, you know, being a student of the markets, and I've been around for the last 30-ish years, the market cap of any country is typically between 0.8 times to 1.2 times the GDP. So the GDP is growing, markets are growing. If the market is in favor, it's more like 1.2 times. If the market is not in favor, it's like 0.8 times. So we think that as, you know, GDP grows, the markets will grow. Now, the other thing that's become very, very important these days is if you look at the EM basket, the big heavyweights, you know, which are China, Russia, Brazil, South Africa, Turkey, these are uninvestable countries, in my opinion. Like, you know, okay. So India remains the only investable country, you know, of the larger EM basket. I think in my conversation with Brian, I made the comment that, you know, I was at Goldman when the acronym BRICS was coined. Today, the eye of the BRICS stands, you know, and that's just fact. So with that, you know, Ben and Michael, if you look at India's weightage in the MSCI EM basket, that has grown fairly steadily, like, you know, over the last, you know, it used to be, and yeah, I'm going to read some statistics to you, which is, it used to be 6% between 2003 and 2013. Then sort of, you know, it went up to 10% from December 2013 to 2023, and now it's at 17%. So as passive money is flowing in, and that's sort of making the market more attractive as we go.
So India is going to pass China's stock market in terms of EM in the next, whatever, 5 years or so.
You know, probably. What? The thing has been that we have grown up being Western educated. You know, we've grown up looking at the world through the MSCI ACWI prism, where we say, hey, you know, the US is 40% or 50% of the market cap, so 50% of the assets should be here. EM is 10%, but in the EM basket, this is this and that's that. That's a very naive way of looking at the world. Not a wrong way, a naive way. If you're the head of a manufacturing company, say Boeing, you don't have an MSCI ACWI EM strategy. You have a China strategy and you have an India strategy, but that's where you sell planes, you know. So we think that lumping all emerging markets into one lot. And so that gives you a very, very mixed picture rather than looking at the markets or looking at each market separately. Now, and that's the case for India today.
There's been the case that the stock market is not the economy. And I think China is probably the poster child for that statement, where the GDP grew at, whatever, making this up, 6% a year, and the stock market returns were, you know, nothing effectively. What would be the transmission mechanism for which GDP growth in India would translate into stock market increases?
Michael, great question. GDP growth in India will translate to higher consumer discretionary spending. Every point in GDP growth translates to 5x of consumer discretionary spending because basic consumer needs already met. All marginal income is going into discretionary spending. If discretionary spending goes up, leads to higher earnings. Higher earnings just lead to higher prices. You know?
So my question is, if we're getting on the India train and we see this economic growth coming and it's unstoppable, basically, why wouldn't you just invest passively in India? What's the difference? So you have a more active fund and a more concentrated fund. Why invest in a more active approach? And what are some of the themes that you see an active approach can help that maybe aren't picked up in a passive approach?
Ben, if you look at the passive approach, and I'm not in any way saying the passive approach won't work. If you look at the composition of the Nifty, okay, and if you, the passive approach would be 100% there if you believe the composition of the Nifty reflected the growth in GDP and the growth in consumer discretionary spending. If you look at, you know, the heavyweights in the index, they're largely IT companies. As you know, that India has a large number of very, very large cap, mega cap IT companies, you know, the Infosys of the world, the TCSs of the world, the Wipros of the world. The growth drivers for a Wipro or an Infosys or one of any of these big, you know, IT companies is not GDP growth in India. They happen to be from India, but their markets are all in the West. So H-1B policy in the United States, labor laws in the United States have a much greater effect on the earnings of these companies than India consumer growth. You know? So IT is one of them. Next one is pharma. If you know, if either of us, all three of us, if any one of the three of us has a single generic medicine here in the US.
I'm bald. Do you have anything for baldness?
I'm sure there is, but you know, Michael, I'll take you on a trip to India for that. You know, they'll sell you something. That's a must, you know. But generic, you know, pharma, India, you know, exports over $120 billion of generic pharma to the United States and Western Europe, et cetera, et cetera. Now, India has the second largest number of FDA-approved manufacturing facilities outside the US, I mean, after the United States, okay. So now, if you look at pharma, big pharma, what drives big pharma is Medicare reimbursement policy, NIH reimbursement policy in the UK. It's not domestic growth in India. So you have large sections or chunks of the index which are dominated by these big companies. You know, you take oil, for example, crude prices, you know. There are two heavyweights, Reliance, ONGC, that are dominated by oil prices. Oil prices are set globally. They've got nothing to do with consumer growth in India. So it's the parallel I draw, Ben, is very simply, if you buy the FTSE thinking you bought UK growth, FTSE's got nothing to do with UK growth, you know. Similarly, the Nifty, probably about 40% of the Nifty is actually focused on India consumer growth. We are a vast majority focused on the growth of the Indian consumer in the short term, medium term, longer term. And then we play a number of themes around that, you know.
Is it as simple as retailers or how far does that consumer go?
No,
like
so,
what are the simple ways it translates?
Yeah. So it translates, Ben, into things like the country was largely unbanked, still is. So financials and financial inclusion, you know, which essentially is a key part of sort of, you know, the development, you know, of any economy, you know. Financials are a large part of that, you know. Now, financials are a large part of that. Consumer discretionary is also a large part of that. Consumer staples is also part of that. Because what you have is, as, you know, the country grows sort of, you know, wealthier, if you want to call it that, and people enter the middle class, et cetera, you now have essentially demand for, you know, packaged goods, higher quality packaged goods, things like that. So, you know, it sort of translates into a whole bunch of different industries that and sectors that you can, you know, get into. Things like hospitals, you know, things like hospitals, the need for healthcare, you know, need for healthcare, formal healthcare, things like that are growing at an alarming pace in India as people have the means to spend for this, you know.
It's typical for emerging market countries, stock markets, and I know it's a broad basket, to trade at a discount to the United States in terms of multiples of earnings, cash flow, whatever you want to look at. I'm curious, what does the Indian market look like with such favorable demographics, positive outlook? Does it trade at a smaller discount or maybe even a premium?
It trades at a premium to the S&P, you know.
Hmm.
It always has.
Oh, really? Wow. It's,
I didn't know that either.
It always has, you know. And that is about to get bigger as the amount of money coming into India only grows. Like, you know, I have three children. Tara is my daughter, youngest one of my three. If she asks me, why is the market going up? More buyers than sellers, you know. It's as simple as that, you know. It's as simple as that. So
are there any parts of the stock market that are cheaper and have a valuation discount that you can see that like people haven't figured it out yet or not really?
There certainly are. There certainly are pieces of them that are not as well followed, you know, and not as hyped. But, you know, we don't typically look at that because India has about 5,000 or 6,000 listed companies. In our investable universe, there's only about 300, 400 names, you know, 300 names. That's about it. There's only about 800 names that even pass the basic filters, you know, of, say, $150 million market cap and a minimum trading volume in a day, which is our very first, you know, screen that we run on the universal stocks, you know.
So let's talk about your portfolio. Where do you come from in terms of your background in security selection? Are you top down, bottoms up, quantitative, qualitative, screens, technicals, fundamentals? What are you looking at?
For the IOPP product, we are purely bottoms up stock pickers. Okay. What we do is we start with identifying an investable universe. So for that, we use a market cap and a liquidity screen, which is at the very basic, you know, level. Then we basically use a bunch of sector-specific sort of factors, things like, you know, return on invested capital, you know, how asset light is it, et cetera, et cetera. And those sector-specific factors essentially take the universe down from about 800 names down to about 300 names. And then we apply what we call a four-pillar sort of framework to it. You know, we look at management quality, which is the most critical and the most important of all sort of, you know, stock selections or criteria. We look at...
Wait, hold on. Before you move on to the other three, and we'll get there, I'm just curious why you say that management selection is so critical to your framework.
Again, Michael, if you're going to hold a stock for 3 to 5 years, you have to be confident in the quality of the management. You have to make absolutely certain that the management is shareholder friendly. Now, India is dominated by conglomerates, family-owned conglomerates. We were typically not very efficient allocators of capital. I'll give you an example, Michael. You know, son comes to the United States to study. He studies computer science. They're in, you know, XYZ manufacturing. They say, oh, he's just come back from the US. Why don't we start an IT company for him? And they suddenly start allocating capital into this, which we believe is a poor allocation of capital. Management quality, you know, ethical concerns, fraud, et cetera, is rampant. You know, what you see in, you know, disclosed financials, et cetera, you have to triangulate multiple ways in smaller companies to make absolutely certain. Again, you know, not in the recent past, but, you know, about 15, 17 years back, there was a fairly large IT company called Satyam listed in the New York Stock Exchange, you know. All the numbers were, you know, fraudulent, you know.
So how do you quantify management, or is this more of a qualitative assessment?
It's a qualitative assessment, but again, we look at how many years they've been a public company, how shareholder friendly are they, how transparent are they in communication, you know, do they really act that way or do they just say that? Everyone has an ESG policy and this and that. But once you start peeling the onion, you know exactly who's what, et cetera. Then, you know, a lot of companies, as you know, which has been in the news, essentially use, I'll put this delicately, their proximity to governments, et cetera, to enhance the bidding process and that. We stay away from companies like that because and that's a worldwide phenomenon. You know? I see that as much in the United States as I see that in India. But if there's a company that, you know, if there's a conglomerate that's particularly close to any sort of government and actually has used its connections to the government to enhance its own, you know, good, we know that when the government changes and in India governments do change, they'll be the first ones out, you know.
When you're doing this qualitative assessment, I've heard it both ways from international managers. Some say you have to have boots on the ground. You have to have people there to get to understand it better and understand the culture and understand the people and talk to them. And other people say, no, you don't have to. We can. It's easier than ever because the world is flatter. Where do you fall on that line in terms of boots on the ground research?
You know, the name of the podcast is Talking Up Your Book. Given the extensive boots that we have on the ground, 6 or 7 people on the ground, 4 offices, most of them who've grown up in India, know the products cold, you know, have grown up in that ecosystem, that environment, we think there's no substitute whatsoever to having boots on the ground. Boots on the ground doesn't mean every 6 months you sort of fly in, meet the management, shake hands, kiss a few babies and get out. That's me. You know, it's really our people on the ground that actually touch and feel everything that they do, you know, that these companies do. I'll give you another example of why boots on the ground helps and why, Ben, when he said that if you're sitting here, you know, you can do it as well, is we've talked about, you know, consumer growth in India. That's a very heterogeneous concept. It is concentrated in different pockets. It's actually a stark divide between urban consumer growth and rural consumer growth, you know. And urban consumer growth, there are pockets, there are states in which it's happening. Like, you know, if you're sitting here, India could look like a monolith to you. Couldn't be further from the truth, you know. So if you've grown up in India, if you've traveled in India, if you know local tastes in India, you're in a much better position. India has 16 official languages, all with their own script.
Hmm.
It's actually a collection of 600 kingdoms which the British wove into a country, you know, by imposing common language and common law. I'm born in India. I grew up there. I tried to build a business after I graduated in 1988. Failed. Came to grad school here in the United States, you know. It's only when I was in grad school, investment biker, you know, name is escaping me. And this is what happens when you go old. Jim Rogers. Just completed that. He came in and he was talking about India on his bike, you know, on his investment biker tour and said, India is like the Balkans. It's a aggregation of 600 kingdoms woven together into a country by the British by imposing common law and common language, you know. Now, he said this, you know, about the Balkans when they were all part of the Soviet Union, you know. Or I think it was just falling apart then. Now, could that happen in India? I don't know. But India is a very, very diverse country. You don't feel that if you're sitting here and you just travel to the big metropolitan cities, which have as luxurious hotels as anyone else, you can sort of not see any of the India. It's only when you start traveling in India and go from region to region, etc., you know what the differences are. And how do you take advantage of those, you know?
So we spoke about your first pillar, which was management selection. What are the other three that go into your process?
The others are, you know, around sustainable growth, you know. Does the industry or the sector have a long runway for growth? Yes or no, you know. It is on a secular, on an industry level. And there I'll tell you, what are the threats to the moats, if you want to call it that? And every manager probably talks to you about this. But I'll give you an example there. Infant formula or baby food, you know, as we know it, that cannot be advertised in India. So you have big global consumer companies like, you know, Unilever or, you know, Procter & Gamble, etc., that have their own consumer formula. As the middle class is growing, the demand for that is growing, you know, because they want a Western brand and they want a globally accepted sort of, you know, big brand. But the threat to competition coming in there is very low because it cannot be actually advertised, you know. So we look at those secular moats that exist. And then we look at sort of, you know, the key performance indicators of the companies, et cetera, to see, you know, is the moat sustainable? What are the threats to it, et cetera, you know.
Talking about moats, are you a Buffett-like investor where you're going to hold some of these concentrated stocks for a very long time, or do you have a lot of turnover?
No, we do have enough turnover. We do turn over something like 120% a year, which is 10%, which is not like 5% a year or zero, but it's not like what we do in our hedge fund. You know, we run high frequency trading businesses. We run like hedge funds where if people sort of hear about the turnover, they're like, whoa, that's not investing. So that's the business of making money. Like, you know, anyway, here we are looking to hold stocks for 3 to 5 years. We have to be comfortable holding stocks for 3 to 5 years. And we have our own valuation methodologies, which I can go into in any case. And we have a 1 year price target and a 3 year price target. You know? So again, we are looking to hold these stocks for a relatively long period of time, 3 to 5 years, you know, at the minimum. Now, sometimes what happens, you know, Ben, is that you get into a stock, it basically catches fire, goes up very, very quickly. And before you know it, your 1 year price target is it. And before you know it, within the year, your 3 year price target is it. So we have elaborate reviews to figure out, in spite of the market rewarding this particular stock, is it something new that we missed and it's still got the same runway of growth? Or is all the growth sort of front-loaded and the stock price is reflecting that? You know,
you mentioned that relationship between GDP and market caps. So you said the GDP of India is, what, $4 trillion and change, something like that?
Somewhere there.
I've done this before where I've compared emerging market stock markets, their market capitalization, to individual companies. So India's stock market must be also in that range, around $3 or $4 trillion
total? It's in the $4.4 trillion now.
Okay, so we're talking like Apple plus Amazon or something for the Indian stock market. Something like that. So in terms of like the runway. And the other thing you mentioned is that you said there's 5,000 to 6,000 stocks in the Indian stock market, which is interesting because there's in the Wilshire 5,000. Now in the US, there's what, 3,500? So why are there so many more publicly traded companies in India? Is it easier to go public there? What's the story there?
Yeah, there's multiple reasons for that, Ben. One is that the consolidation of the markets in India happened relatively recently, where there's only two major stock exchanges today, which is the National Stock Exchange and the Bombay Stock Exchange. If you go back even 15, 20 years back, you know, every major city had its own stock market. You know, so the Calcutta had a stock market, Chennai had a stock market, New Delhi had a stock market, Baroda had a stock market. And a lot of the smaller companies listed in these things and just have contributed to the very, very large tail. Like, you know, so again, you know, while, you know, that long tail exists, it's really sort of the larger cap, more liquid names that where most of the action is. Like, you know.
And that's kind of the pond that you fish in, the larger names.
The pond that we fish in is, you know, stocks which are at least $1 billion plus in market cap, could be slightly less. But so $1 billion to $5 billion is considered a mid cap in India. Below $1 billion is a small cap. Above $5 billion is a large cap. You know.
How quickly are the companies that you're investing in growing? Are they like is it mid-teens or is it like blistering breakneck pace or what exactly?
Michael, it's a combination of all of them, because if you have blistering growth, but the price already reflects that, what good is that to an investor? Like, you know?
Right.
So, you know, again, I mean, you know, what we do again is we look at sort of company specific modeling, like a discounted dividend model, you know, intrinsic valuation, and we look at comparative valuation and a bunch of different valuation methodology to come up with our own methodology. You know. And of course, if the price already reflects that, you don't want to get in then, like, you know.
Anupam, you've been in this business for a while. What would you say to somebody who's considering an investment in your product, but might be hesitant because it's a newish vehicle, there's not a long track record here, and there's not a ton of assets? What would you say to that person?
What I'd say to them is very simply, you're buying actively managed India from a very reputed platform, Simplify. You know, we have India expertise. We've run money in India. You know, we've got close to about $550 million in the hedge fund assets. We've got an enviable track record when it comes to the hedge fund world. And we have boots on the ground in India. So when it comes to India Alpha, we know that story really well. We're not saying take 100% of your network, put it there. But, you know, just how fast India is growing, every portfolio requires a certain portion of the very fast growing economy in the, you know, in their portfolio. Like, you know.
Anupam, we've spoken a lot about the exciting developments and growth that's occurring in India's economy and how it's translating into the market. What are some of the risks that investors should be aware of?
Some of the enthusiasm about India is about political stability, the Modi government, how well it's done for the country in the last 10 years. Elections are just starting. And, you know, while there's consensus that Modi is going to win a majority, it's priced to perfection. Any sort of surprises in the election will lead to a sharp sell-off in the market. Okay. India is extraordinarily susceptible to crude prices. 80% of our import bill is crude. With the problems that we have in the Middle East since October of last year with the Israel-Hamas war, we were surprised that crude prices did not move much. Now with, you know, Iran directly targeting Israel, we've seen a slight movement up. You know, crude India is extraordinarily susceptible to sort of crude prices, you know, there, you know. And we do believe that commodity inflation, sort of higher for longer, would essentially hurt India somewhat, you know, not very much. Last thing is that India is 55% rural, which is largely agrarian economy, which contributes to about 15% of the GDP. However, that's where the vote banks are, so the constant redistribution of income. If rural growth does not pick up and keep pace with urban growth, typically governments will get voted out of power, and it is quite, you know, that's a risk, you know, that's a risk to the markets, you know. The last two or three things I'll make, India's had a very stable political environment, unlike most of the emerging markets, you know. I mean, democratically elected now, you know, I mean, India's been a continuous democracy since 1947, except for a 2-year stint, you know, in between 75 and 77. India's currency has remained remarkably stable for one reason only. The government has been very prudent in managing its deficits, and Indian sovereign bonds for the first time have been now included in the JP Morgan Global Index and the Bloomberg Index, which is going to lead to $20 to $40 billion a year in inflows into India, into the bond markets, you know. So again, you know, everything looks sort of rosy for India, but I think it's in a very poor neighborhood. We've got a failed state. That's a nuclear state to our northwest. And, you know, we're at war with China. You know, we fought a war in 62. I believe we are still technically at war with them. There's a 10 or 15,000 kilometer border with a low-grade firing going on, you know, between people. Flares up from time to time, but large parts, about 2,000 kilometers of that is disputed. So, you know, again, you know, it's a risk, you know, to the country.
Where can we send people to learn more?
All the information is on the Simplify website, including the deep dive videos and, you know, a lot of the fact sheets, etc.
Okay.
All right, Anupam, this is great. Really insightful. Appreciate you coming on today.
My pleasure. Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Ben. Thanks, everyone.
All right. Thank you again, Simplify Asset Management. Remember, simplify.us to learn more. Email us, animalspirits@thecompoundnews.com.